This is Wade Rathke. You're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 FM is located, or the east side of New Orleans, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. A podcast will be available of this show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Jack McNamara in Chicago, who was the lead organizer and founder of something called the Contract Buyers League almost 50 years ago. What in the world was the Contract Buyers League, Jack? Welcome to Wade's World.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Contract Buyers League started in 1967. It originally came into being as a result of a community organizing project working on a Presentation Parish in Chicago. At the time, I was a Jesuit seminarian, and Monsignor Egan, the pastor there, who had been the archdiocesan director of the Office for Urban Affairs.
The legendary Monsignor Jack Egan, yes indeed. We miss him today, don't we?
We certainly do. He had come looking for seminarians to work one day a week in his parish, called it Operation Saturation, and gave us the impossible assignment of, in one day a week, he assigned everybody a block, and the challenge was to make a community out of that block. But after we'd knock on doors on a Saturday, he would have us come back to the rectory around 3:30 in the afternoon and would usually have some kind of debriefing and, more often than not, a speaker for us. And on a couple of occasions, the speaker turned out to be Tom Gaudet, who was an Alinsky-trained organizer. And
former insurance man.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. He had a great story about how Saul Alinsky recruited him on an airplane.
At any rate, I was incredibly impressed by the fact that he kept hammering away at two principles. One was that you don't do anything working in a community like North Lawndale without consulting the people first and listening to what they saw as the problems. And the second thing was that the people in the community had to be participating in the planning and implementation of anything that was decided to be done.
Okay.
And so shortly after Christmas that year, I asked Monsignor Egan if I could, along with another seminarian, spend the summer organizing, and he thought that that was a good idea and went to help me get permission from my superior to do that. And at Easter time that year, one of my former students, whom I had taught at St. Xavier High School in Cincinnati, a young man named by the name of Peter Cassidy, was visiting at Easter time. And when he was a freshman at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, and he asked me what I was doing for the summer. And I said I was going to be organizing and told him a little bit about it. And he said, would you ever be interested in having college students do this with you? And I said, why, sure.
What the heck, yeah.
And I really didn't think that many parents would let their recent high school graduates or young sons in college be able to allow them to come to Chicago and live for the summer in the
West Side. 50 years ago, it was amazing what parents allowed their young sons to do. I mean, we wouldn't think at all about some of those things. But back then, that was not as big a decision. But What was North Lawndale like then? Because that's 50 years ago. Things change in a city like Chicago or Little Rock or anywhere else. Give us a sense of what you were looking at block by block.
Well, North Lawndale was almost 100% African-American community. The population was very dense. I don't remember the numbers, but it was about twice as many and maybe even more people as are living in North Lawndale today. And it was kind of a hot spot on the west side. There were gangs and a fair amount of violence and all that sort of thing. And it was a place where it made sense to watch keep your eyes open for what might be happening. And it also, something that kind of happened to me was when I first moved in, I wondered why there was so much broken glass on the sidewalk. And after living here for a couple months, I felt like breaking glass myself. part of that may have been because I was living in a 5-room apartment with a bunch of college students. We had 2 bedrooms. One of them had 6 bunks in it, 3 bunks high, and the other had 4 bunks in it, just 2 bunks high.
Like an Indian train, yeah, okay.
And so, you know, the quarters were tight, et cetera. But what was interesting is that we decided that we were going to hit the streets, knocking on doors, listening, and every one of us had a block. And in the process of doing that, several things came up, but the most significant or most important thing was I was sitting in a living room one evening with a widow who had 4 kids. She was making $5,000 a year at the post office, which in 1967
was not bad money.
Was a good middle class salary. Her mother was making $4,000 a year working in a hospital at night scrubbing floors. And so the two of them were together raising these 4 children. And as we were talking, Mrs. Arbertha said to me, you know, I think I could make it if I didn't have this huge house payment. And there was a tear coming down her cheek as she said it. And I said to her, what is your house payment? And she said, $248 a month. Just a couple years before that, my father was dying. I was the oldest in the family.
And so almost half of her income.
True.
Okay.
And so anyway, when I was going through college, I was working, and my mother and I, between us with 5 kids, I was the oldest, were making just a little bit more than that, and we were having trouble making ends meet. But I was making the house payment on our house in Skokie, suburban Skokie, and our house payment was only $108 a month compared to her $248.
Wow.
And I told her that, and both of us knew that there was something wrong. We didn't know what it was, but we knew that
something smelled wrong.
And so I proceeded to take the matter up with Monsignor Egan, and he said, oh, I've heard a little bit about this, but you got to go talk to John McKnight. John McKnight was at the time the Midwest director for the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And John knew everything that there was to know about contracts, set us up with a lawyer to show us how to do title searches, which in that day was a pretty...
It took a lot of elbow grease and good eyes back then, didn't it?
Was a pretty torturous deal.
Exactly.
Because you'd have to go to the Chicago Title and Trust Company to get document numbers, and then you'd go read microfilms in the basement of City Hall, and you'd have to count the tax stamps so that you could figure out what the seller bought the property for and what he sold it for, etc. But we did it on an 8-block area and found that every one of these contracts was the same. or similar, I should say.
These weren't mortgages.
These were not mortgages. They were the seller. What happened is we normally think of a real estate transaction being a direct transaction between a buyer and a seller. And the function of a real estate person is to act as a broker or go-between, bringing people together. In this case, the seller actually bought the property from the outgoing White family for what was approximately market value. It may have been slightly below, but not drastically below. And at that time, the average home on the west side was selling for, say, $15,000. And then the seller would turn around a couple days later and sell it to a black family for $25,000. And so the markup of $10,000 seemed high, but when you thought about it, and the fact that the person, the buyer, was paying interest on an additional $10,000 over the life of a 20-year life of a contract. At that time, all mortgages even were 20 years, not 30 years like they are today, or even more.
Right.
And they'd pay $20,000 more to own a home than if they were white. And these were people who were middle-class people. They had all the values of middle class, of the middle class. They believed in two-parent families. They believed in holding the same job for not switching from job to job. They also believed in good educations for their kids. They believed in home ownership, et cetera. And what's unfortunate is that the scheme of contract selling and contract buying made it impossible for them to enjoy the benefits of being middle class and subscribing to American middle class values.
We're talking to Jack McNamara in Chicago, who we're talking about something 50 years ago, although you'll hear soon it's right in the front pages today as well. But we're talking about contract buying and organizing the Contract Buyers League. So when you talk about them buying a house, so it's a strange kind of contract because it was almost a month-to-month, not rent to buy or lease to buy, but just you could lose the house if you missed a payment, couldn't you?
Yeah, there are several things about a contract that could be horrible. One was an excessive sales price, which obviously was the case.
Yeah, you've demonstrated that, yeah.
Interest rates can be high, although at that time, we never considered interest rates to be an issue because Illinois had a usury law that capped interest rates at 7%.
Arkansas had one at 10% at that time. I can still remember the campaigns to try to get rid of it in the late 70s, yeah.
And then the repairs on the house, usually the seller left the repairs, became the responsibility of the buyer, probably in addition to the inflated selling price, the lack of equity in your home, in their homes until they made the very last payment was the other most horrible part of it. And essentially what that means is that if they missed a payment, even if it was only 2 months or a month before the final payment was to be made,
they had no equity. They
not only lost the house, but they lost all the money that they had put into it from the down payment, all the sum of all the payments they made, and the sum of all the repairs that they had made over the period of life in the house. So it was a horrible kind of situation.
And it wasn't just Chicago. I know in Little Rock, Arkansas, when we were first organizing Acorn, and hitting doors there in the east and south end, you'd run into people who had bought a house on this system, lost it, were in the second time, in some cases were buying the same house over again from a different seller. And this was, but there's a reason for this, and that had to do with redlining.
That's true. And one of the things that I found kind of stunning was the fact that the federal government was complicit, and other practices in the business community, particularly real estate community, were contributing factors here, really setting up the conditions that made it possible for the contract sellers to exploit the contract buyers in the way they did. And probably the worst of it was the FHA, which had been brought into existence during the Roosevelt administration, had been started to make it possible for low-income Americans to become homeowners. And the way that worked is that the federal government, FHA, would insure the mortgages that the buyers got, and it only required a 3% down payment. And but the regulations were that black folks basically were excluded from taking advantage of this, and areas of the city were redlined as areas in which homes could not be sold to black folks. And there were some...
Literally, there were maps that were color-coded, and the red was a neighborhood where the FHA, Federal Home Administration, thought they were high risk and therefore would not guarantee mortgages. And to think, 3%, they're talking about all the small down payments of 5 and 10% in 2007 as part of the housing crisis, but 3% is what it used to be back then.
Right. And what is also true is that many of the people who were forced to buy on contract, if they had been white, would have qualified for traditional mortgage. And somehow or other, that didn't seem quite right.
So you and your team were finding whole clusters of people in North Lawndale when you were hitting the doors, and you started organizing, obviously, the Contract Buyers League.
True. And right around the same time that I met Mrs. Arbertha, one of the college students met another family who had a comparable story. And a third situation arose where Mrs. Ruth Wells, she and her husband had bought their house about 12 years earlier, and they made their down payment. As soon as they moved in, they had to put in a new roof and a new furnace, which they did. They never were a day late for their payment. And they were supposed to, in the contract, it said that they were supposed to get their deed halfway through. And so Mrs. Wells went down to her seller's office and asked to get her deed, as she was entitled to. And he said, "Oh no, you owe me another $1,000 for insurance."
All right.
Well, that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back. Because she immediately, and she wasn't Catholic, by the way, immediately went over to see Senior Egan, because she knew that he was the kind of guy who cared about these things.
Exactly.
And so he sent her over to see us. And so we had an appraisal done on her house. She paid $24,500. The seller had paid $14,000, I believe, and
nice margin.
Made a good margin, and the appraisal by FHA indicated that the price was, or the value of the house was, only $17,000 after she had paid on it for 10 years. So she still couldn't meet the.
They talk about being underwater. She started underwater. She stayed underwater and was still underwater.
Right.
And so obviously CBL put together lots of people in the same situation. I don't want to lose the drama of the payment strike and all y'all had to, all the lawsuits. Unfortunately, we only have 30 minutes. So you started getting people together on regular meetings who had these same problems, started small and became huge.
Well, the first meeting was in January of 68 with 8 people.
There you go.
People were reluctant to talk about being on contract. But then we had a couple of quick victories. And so within a month or so, we started having 200, 300 people at a meeting, because by word of mouth, it traveled across the neighborhood. And then a few months later, even a group from the South Side started coming to the meetings. And we'd go through the normal things. We'd go with each buyer to their seller's office to try to renegotiate. It wouldn't happen. We'd picket them. We'd go to their neighborhoods and tell the neighbors that they had a crook living in the neighborhood, et cetera. But when none of that worked, that people knew how to handle protests of that strike. And so we thought it would be a good idea to have a payment strike, and in keeping with the principle that we started with, we decided that in order to do this, we better have a meeting with 15 families a night until we got through. By that time, it was over 500 families. Okay. So that was a lot of meetings, and people just unanimously wanted to get involved in the payment strike. And the payment strike itself started causing sellers to renegotiate.
So a rent strike obviously was popular at the time as well, as you don't pay rent to the landlord. A payment strike, they wouldn't be paying their monthly payment to the seller. That's put them in some situation with a risk.
What they also did was to make people know that they were willing to make their payments. It was just not to the seller until they got a fair deal. They made out money orders to themselves every month in the same amount as their monthly payment, brought it into the Contract Buyers League office, and we put it into a safety deposit box. The builder who had built homes on the south side refused to renegotiate any contracts. Ultimately, on the west side, and this older homes on the south side, we were able to renegotiate 450 contracts. And the average savings per family was $13,500. The new home people, I thought, were going to be angry because they were all evicted. And so when I asked them about it, they said, oh no, by the time we got evicted, we had saved up $10,000.
We're ready to start again.
And we just went out and bought better homes.
There you go. So in 1965, FHA was forced to change its policy to stop racially discriminating. And in 1975, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act was passed, which meant that banks would have to describe how they loaned in terms of neighborhoods, ethnicity, and race. And in 1977, the Community Reinvestment Act was passed, which barred racial discrimination in lending. But let's fast forward to 2016. We're now, and that's part of why we're talking today, contract buying is back, it seems, despite all of those fights 50 years ago and the victories and struggles. What's happening, Jack?
Well, first of all, the housing crisis that led to the recession was another form of contract selling. It's the mechanics were different, but it was basically exploiting poor, mostly black people in the way they got mortgages, subprime mortgages, and they were steered into these, even if they qualified for a regular mortgage. But then thousands across the country, millions of people were foreclosed upon, and there's a plethora of foreclosed homes that are basically held by the federal government, whether
that's Fannie Mae, and it's just basically dumping onto the market almost now.
And so they're in the business of trying to get what they can for these foreclosed homes. And they're selling them at bargain prices to big-time speculators,
hedge funds, Wall Street, the whole nine yards.
The whole nine yards is right, and they're selling them at even worse, under worse conditions. For example, this one seller or investor bought 8,000 homes, and the average price was $6,700. And he's selling them for $30,000 at 10% interest.
As is.
Buyer's responsible.
That's right.
For all the repairs. And
Again, it's with a contract to deed.
It's a one of a contract for deed. Is exactly right.
And these contracts are different. I mean, there's state laws in some places that are starting to regulate them. But in some states, I know we've been doing the research together, the really boards virtually writing these things. Some places there are some protections, but in the most case, there's no federal protections, not many state protections. This is a scandal, isn't it?
It certainly seems to me that it's a scandal. And as I look at it, there's seven predatory components of a contract. Not all of them are present in every contract, and some are worse than the others. So that if you eliminate one, say, for example, in Ohio, they have some provisions where if the contract is recorded and they paid for 5 years, they can't be evicted as quickly as they could otherwise.
Yeah, they have more time and it can be converted to a regular mortgage and
all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't solve the basic problems of exploitative rates, sales price, or the lack of equity until for the first 5 years of the contract.
And the truth is, and you know, I've been organizing people around housing for a long time, a lot of people don't hold their houses for 5 years. A lot of our constituency does, but many people go into the market and hope to be in another house within 5 years. So there's a reason that they're putting people at risk for 5 years. So what are we hoping to do about all this, Jack? Because that's part of the conversation, is that this is a bad, sort of a bad thing coming back to the forefront. It may be National Consumer Law Center estimates more than 6 million contracts out there. Realty Track estimates 20 to 30,000 a year are being added to this. What's to be done?
Well, I think for the contracts that already exist, we want to try to get them renegotiated at a fair price. I think that somehow or other we need regulation on a national scale for whether it be regulation or litigation or legislation that would eliminate the predatory components, just make it impossible to have any of the predatory components in a contract. Contract in itself is not bad. It's just the addition of these one or more of these predatory components. And then ultimately, because the argument that the speculators use is that there's a lack of credit for poor people, which is true.
Triggering this crisis is banks. There's no subprime market, and banks aren't willing to make these small mortgage loans anymore.
Exactly what it is. And what we hope to do, or eventually, is to be able to create some kind of an entity which will provide fair financing, just financing for poor home buyers.
And we're pretty convinced from what we're hearing and what we're seeing that this continues to be a vulture kind of operation, a bottom feeding effort to take advantage of lower income, Black, Latino, and white families. Right. From everything we can tell, it's going to be largely the Midwest and South where people are most victimized.
Right. Isn't it?
So we're hoping to see what that's like in Chicago 50 years later, but we suspect it's as bad in Ohio, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, and elsewhere.
We know that in Michigan, Detroit, there is an article in the Detroit News that pointed out that more than half of the houses sold in Detroit in 2015 were sold on contract rather than a mortgage.
So one of the things we caution everybody on is that a lot of these sales are being disguised, too, as owner financing or whatever. Some of that's true, but some of these are contract sellers. Hopefully, people will be very careful, because until we can get more traction on this, people are going to be taken advantage of. How can they get a hold of the efforts that you and others are involved in on contract buying?
The first thing is we have a website, which is probably the best way, contractbuyersleague.com or .org. I'm not sure which it is.
You know, I think if you go on Google or any search engine and just put Contract Buyers League, you go right to it, is what I've been told. So they can find that.
And we'll have ways to get in touch with us.
So it's got some of the history of the campaigns. Right. And then as we start developing current research, there'll be more of it. So We're going to be hearing a lot more, I think, in coming days, months, and years about efforts to stop contract buying altogether. Thank you for being with us, Jack McNamara, who has been a leader in this area. This has been Wage World for another week. The world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. We say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.